Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'm here to keep you company for the next hour or so on News Talk as we dive into some of the big stories making the news in business and politics here in Ireland and all around the world. Coming up in the UK this week, Boris Johnson's new book was unleashed and the Tory leadership race was upended. Politics in the UK is never short on drama. And John Crace is from The Guardian and he's the parliamentary sketch writer there. He is never far from that drama and he'll be joining me later to take us through the week's events. And I'll be asking later on if Intel and what it's up to in Germany should serve as a cautionary tale for policymakers here in Ireland. And finally, FIFA's transfer rules get slammed by the European Court of Justice. Could this verdict be about to shake up international football as we know it? You can email me at takingstock@newstalk.com or tweet at StockNT. Now, what do you think of when you hear the phrase freedom of movement in an EU context? I bet you it's not the life of a top class world football player. Well, in what could be a historic judgment, the European Court of Justice found in favour of the French player Lassana Diarra in a case that he took against his former club, Lokomotiv Moscow. And I'm delighted now that Javier Espinoza, the EU correspondent for the Financial Times, is joining me again here on Taking Stock to explain the judgment itself and what it could all mean for world football. Javier, you're welcome back.
Thank you so much, Mandy.
Now, before we get into the ruling and the implications of that, maybe just give us a bit of background about Lassana Diarra, who exactly he is and why he took this case in the first place.
So he is a former French international player who a decade ago challenged the rules, which is quite straightforward and actually that the rules FIFA prohibit or blocks players from moving freely from one club to another. If you think about it as a listener, if you have a job, essentially you get a better contract, somebody offers you more money, and you are captured by the rules that block you from taking a new job. So imagine how you would feel if that was the case. Mm. And he actually claimed that the rules were impeding the rules set by FIFA, which is the football's governing body, was preventing him from actually moving to another club. That was it, back in 2014. He left his Russian club before ending his contract, and that led to the club to file a complaint against FIFA because he was breaking his contract rules.
Yeah, and so is the former rules as they stood, is it this, that if a player ends a contract prematurely, that the new club that he is going to, they then are liable for whatever fines that he has to pay to get out of that contract?
Correct. And in this case, FIFA ordered Diarra to pay, you know, not small change, but 10 million euros in damages to his former club. And also, at the same time, he couldn't move or transfer to the Belgian football club, Charleroi. So, as I say, just imagine this in your everyday context. You know, it wouldn't be acceptable for anyone in employment.
Yeah, and so what was the final judgment made by the European Court of Justice on this?
So they said that the rules on transfers of professional footballers actually break the rules of free movement. Hmm. And why is this important? Obviously, it affects the case of Diarra himself, but it has wider repercussions, or it could have, because it can still there's still an appeal, and there are various different complaints from football unions and clubs on this, but it could mean, why this is interesting, that if ultimately these rules are found to be completely illegal, that it will set free, or it would mean that these high-profile football players will be able to freely end their contracts, move from one club to the next, without having to have liability for the clubs that are receiving them.
Yeah, so potentially it has implications for for world football, the you know, if, from a very, very what is a lucrative side of the sport, that transfer market, which is a huge part of players, a huge part of various different leagues. But it's been over 20 years, I guess, since another historic football related judgment like this was delivered. And that's the Bosman case. You might maybe remind our listeners what that was about and how that changed things for football at the time.
The Bosman case was one that dates back to 1995. In that case, the decision allowed players to move freely between clubs at the end of their contract. So the difference here is that we have a player that is actually doing it before at the end of the contract. So that's an even more profound change in the way that the rules operate. And as you say, we're not talking, you know, millions. This is a multi-billion dollar transfer market. I mean, it's at the heart of how professional football and how its economic model works. So, you know, this is why it's super relevant.
Yeah, and it, as you alluded to there a moment ago, it's not even just about the transfers themselves. At times, some of the clubs are charged with being tactical about holding on to players, particularly young talent. It's something that you see a lot of the British clubs accused of, buying up this young talent across Europe and then holding on to them, not releasing them. And then, of course, they're not able to leave because of the financial implications, but also because from FIFA's perspective, they don't then get an appropriate transfer certificate. So that's another issue here to look at.
Exactly. And some of the experts, some of the legal and sporting experts that I spoke to when the ruling came out last Friday, actually were talking about this idea that, you know, allowing for this free movement that we don't have completely free movement today of these professional young players, particularly the young ones, it will allow also to develop their activity by going to work for a new club. That could also mean that it's a new era of modernizing the governance of football. We could see, you know, new collective bargaining between employees and employers. It could lead to potentially actually a better enjoyment for the fans themselves, because if you have a free market when, you know, a younger player can move from one place to the other, they can develop their football skills in ways that has not been allowed so far. So, you know, it will be very interesting to see how this also translates to the actual enjoyment of the game.
Yeah, and in the long term, it could have major implications, could actually make things better for collective bargaining. But in the short term, it could cause chaos.
In the short term, it could cause a lot of chaos. I mean, people that I spoke to as well, we're saying this is, you know, an embarrassing defeat for FIFA. It also creates a bit of uncertainty in the global football transfer market. Are we really going to move in the direction of breaking contracts earlier? Are players, now that they have seen this ruling from the Luxembourg court, are they going to try? All these players that, you know, were maybe thinking, oh, you know, I cannot really end my contract earlier, they're getting offers from other clubs, are they really going to start trying and testing the legal waters because of this uncertainty that we have now, because it's not a definite final ruling?
And look, Javier, there's always been this sort of feeling and that football and in some ways the wider sports thing kind of lies a little bit outside normal regulation, even where it extends to courts like the European Court of Justice. Is this more of an effort to try and bring that kind of sporting otherness back into the rules of say what are applied to normal working relationships? And how do FIFA feel about that?
FIFA actually said that they're satisfied with how their key principles and their key rules on this transfer system actually work. In fact, on the day, they told me that they feel that actually they confirmed in the ruling that they were pointing actually to a very narrow challenge of particular parts of the regulation, and that they are going to continue to perhaps make some tweaks here and there, but they don't think that it's changing the rules in their entirety. Of course, the jury is out, no pun intended, on what the actual repercussions are going to be.
Mm. And what's the status of the ruling now? If I'm in a club and I have a contract and I'm not getting played and I've got 6 years to go, but there's a massive fine when we're leaving, I go to my agent, what could happen to me now?
You still are at risk of being penalized for that. So, you know, there is, in fact, a lot of movement from the unions, as I said earlier. So this union called FIFPRO, which represents a lot of the European clubs, European leagues, they're joining forces. They have made a formal complaint in Brussels over their welfare. So it goes even beyond just the penalties to your question. But they are also challenging how FIFA has these rules over busy calendars of matches. So, you know, I think that the football governing body really is under a lot of pressure, like it's never been before.
That's right, because you see an increase of the games and overlapping of competitions in response to TV rights and that ever-growing demand just to have football on TV. The other people that it strikes me this might benefit in a financial sense in the longer term might be the lawyers and the people who are representing these players potentially if they do start to try and use this judgment. Certainly the legal eagles will be pleased to take it to the courts for them.
As I have learned in my years covering the legal beat here in Brussels, the more uncertainty, the more friction between a governing body and the players in this case, the more the need for lawyers and, you know, they're very expensive timesheets. So you shouldn't be too worried about the future of the legal profession.
No, I think they'll do okay. Javier, before I let you go, where do you see this going now? And were you surprised when this decision came out at how emphatic it was?
I actually was surprised. I thought that it was, you know, typically the courts, which I've been following for a few years now, are a bit more reserved in the way that they give judgment. And I think this is quite, you know, it was brutally received as an endorsement of what the players are trying to do. However, having said that, you know, the due process and the legality of things, and we were talking about timesheets and lawyers, you can be sure that FIFA is not going to sit around and do nothing. And they will also try to use all the legal arsenal and tools available to them to actually try and fight this, because it really is a disruptor. It goes at the heart of how players in these multi-million contracts have been transferred in the history of, you know, the way that football is played in modern times.
Final point on this, no surprise, I guess, that the legal eagle behind all of this, Jean-Louis Dupont, was also involved in that other very famous case, the Jean-Marc Bosman case, and that European Super League. So he's obviously somebody who is like the Johnny Cochran of international football rules.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, I think that we should expect more legal battles. As I said, there's unions that are gathering, making complaints on the calendar issue. I know that that's a separate but related point, which is of these players wanting to have more freedom. So it'll be interesting to see how that shapes up in terms of where players go and the combinations that you could see on this elite football clubs and the experience that the fans get ultimately, which is, you know, why we care about this.
Which is why we care about this indeed. Well, Javier, listen, I know you're on the move and we really do appreciate you taking the time out to talk to us today. That was Javier Espinoza, the EU correspondent for the Financial Times. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. Now, what Intel are up to in Germany is very, very interesting, and it could have major implications for Intel's policy here in Ireland. After the break, we'll be looking into all of that, so don't go anywhere. Now, electric cars, EU industrial policy, the future direction of the German economy, and one of the multinationals that formed the backbone of our own economy here in Ireland. Now, I just need to put a bit of context on this story, because we all know that electric cars require really powerful chips to make them operate. And the EU, under the leadership of Ursula von der Leyen, had hoped to kickstart the European EV industry by making Europe a force to be reckoned with in the chip making market. To do that, she was going to be helped by the owners of Intel with two large facilities in Europe. That was the plan, and it's gone slightly awry. But I'm delighted now to be joined by Peter Hake from Politico Europe to go through what's happened and why. Peter, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Hello.
Let's start with Intel, if we can, please, because the company itself and the status of it is as an important part of this. So what's been going on recently in Intel in terms of numbers?
Well, very clear that Intel has been racking up major losses. And of course, that has some implications because, of course, when you have losses, you need fresh cash, especially since Intel has this major plan to expand its production capacity. And for that, you need, of course, cash to establish those new factories. But that's not easy if you're racking up losses. So that's currently what's going on inside Intel.
Mm. So the Intel company was a big part of Ursula von der Leyen's plans to enhance the EV chip making market in Europe, and those plans were to happen in Germany. What happened?
So indeed, in 2022, the European Union presented a plan that wanted to boost the chip making capacity inside Europe, because during the pandemic, the Europe had faced some shortages, and especially this was very concerning for the car manufacturers, who are indeed very reliant on chips, especially for their not only for their electrification, but also to make the cars more autonomous, for example.
Mm.
So this plan came into existence in 2022, and then you had Intel coming in, and Intel said, like, okay, Europe, we're going to help you with that. We're going to they planned new factories in Germany and Poland, and also some other facilities around Europe. And then, of course, the troubles began at Intel. So Intel wanted first more subsidies from, for example, Germany and Poland. And now they essentially have said that both facilities are going to be paused for another 2 years.
Mm.
So this is really a setback for actually the whole Europe. And for the European plans.
And is that because Germany is such a linchpin of the German economy, of the European economy? We did a program on this, a deep dive into the German economy a number of months ago. And one of the things that at the time they were talking about was putting a huge store back into car manufacturing as one of those traditional industries that they would have been known for. And of course, lost out to China because of these chips. So does it kind of undermine Germany's ambition to restore itself, not just the European project, but its own economy to underpin that?
Well, it's definitely a writing on the wall for the German economy, because chip making is super expensive.
Mm.
You need actually a lot of subsidies, or manufacturers demand a lot of subsidies to make these factories happen. And of course, these factories can, of course, benefit the home market, because indeed Germany is, of course, known as a economy that is really focused on its car industry. It's a bit the Intel plant was not so much focused on the car industry, that was more focused on advanced chips, for example, for smartphones and data centers. But other plants and other projects that are planned in the country, also for chips, were very much focused on the chips, on the car industry. For example, there was also one from a Taiwanese TSMC, one of the biggest chip makers in the world, that was very much focused on the car industry, and is actually still happening. But it kind of shows how difficult it is for these chip manufacturers to keep their projects afloat. even with massive subsidies. And that's a blow for the European economy, but also for the German economy, because around the Intel factory that was planned in eastern Germany, there was a new industry park planned, there were new roads planned, and you already saw that some of the suppliers, for example, of Intel and other companies in the space were already opening new branches in this region. So it is definitely concerning, because this is actually a whole sector and a whole region that is now not happening for the moment.
And Peter, those subsidies that you mentioned that they got from Germany and from Poland, like, how much were they worth, and can they be repurposed, or what happens to those subsidies now from a German government perspective?
Well, since the project is only paused for 2 years, they're still committed. So Olaf Scholz said after Intel paused the plans for 2 years that the country is still committed to the Intel factory. So for now, they're not going anywhere, those subsidies. And in terms of how much subsidies they get, so the whole Intel project in Germany was around 30 billion. That's quite a number. And Germany has pledged around 10 billion, so almost one third of the project would have been subsidies. Of course, now since this project is now a bit on hold, it's currently unclear how this will impact the budget, because of course these subsidies have to come out of the budget; they have to be committed in a certain year. So it's currently still unclear if the money that was going to be pledged, if that's going to be redoubled, actually.
And so, sorry, you don't know how much damage this might actually do, just this delay to the German economy itself?
That's hard to tell, because there was already some preparatory work being done, and it's really hard to say how much the impact of Intel would have been on the German economy. Mm. Of course, again, you have suppliers coming in, you have extra economic activity around such a factory, but it's really hard to say what the impact is, because it's, for now, it's only paused for 2 years. Building a chip factory actually takes a lot of years. The plan was always that there would have been 4 to 5 years of building. So if you now have a pause of extra 2 years, it's actually pushed further into the future. So it will be more like 2030 at the very earliest.
And do people believe that? I mean, we know that Intel is such a huge global player still, but they're obviously under pressure from their competitors. Is there a belief that this is just a pause, or do they think that this is just something that's going to be maybe kicked down the road indefinitely?
Well, it's definitely a slippery slope to say, because earlier this year we already had reported that Intel already paused other plans, for example, in Italy and France. They had smaller projects there. It was more about smaller manufacturing and research and development. And of course, if you see this big plan now crumbling apart, because now it's also Germany, Poland, so that is being targeted. Mm. The only stronghold is actually still Ireland, because there they have an existing plant. And it's, of course, much more easier to just expand what you already have than to break ground on something completely new, because the project in Germany was meant to be completely something new, a real greenfield project, as they call that, instead of expanding an existing plant. So that's an entirely different thing to do.
So actually, this could be, ironically, good news for us if they want to consolidate and, you know, do more where they are already established. This potentially could be good news for Ireland.
That's true, because throughout the different, because when there were already concerns about the different projects, they have consistently said that they are committed to Ireland. So definitely, that's good news for the Irish economy, because there you already had some expansions, some continued investments. So that's something that they definitely hold on to for now.
And Peter, what about the wider question of the implications of this across Europe, and particularly for Ursula von der Leyen, who just brought in her new council? And a big part of her message was about competitiveness, building back the European economy stronger, being more competitive in a global sense. How has this affected that ambition for her, or damaged the EU project in that sense?
That's a very good remark that you're making there, because indeed, like currently in Brussels, all the debate is about we want to restore Europe's industrial fabric. We want to make Europe competitive again. But if you look at one of the biggest pieces of industrial policy that she already has done, that was the EU Chips Act, that was the chip making plan that she put forward in 2022. And the whole rhetoric about that plan was for a long time that it was actually a big success. They have repeatedly said that about 100 billion euros in private investment was pledged under the Chips Act. But now that's actually slowly falling apart. Of course, they will always say like, yeah, but it's only a pause. It's only on hold for 2 years. So they kind of want to keep that idea that it was a success, alive. But it's spelling trouble for indeed the pitch that they're making, that they want to restore Europe's competitiveness, that they want to restore that industrial fabric, because chip making was the first area where they wanted to do that, and that's not now not a success. And some of the elements that have plagued the chips plan, like for example high energy costs. Germany was really plagued by high energy costs for 2 winters. That was one of the reasons why Intel asked for more subsidy, because you had this spike in energy costs. That is of course also targeting other industries. That's not only chip factories need that flow of energy. Other factories need it as well. So it's kind of worrying to see that when at the start of her second term, indeed, she's speaking about competitiveness, about the industrial policy is a big theme at the moment here in Brussels. But the first area where she tried it, she actually failed.
Yeah, not off to a good start. Just one final question, if I can, Peter, on this. You mentioned there high energy costs and energy security, and the security supply is obviously something that is deeply connected to this issue of data centres, which are growing by the new time because of AI. And one of the reasons why they're concerned about, and we've had this debate here in Ireland by the new time coming in, is there's not enough energy supply. So back to that competitiveness thing, if Europe are going to try and get more of these data centres into them, it's not that we have an oversupply of data centres, it's that we have an undersupply of energy. And is that something, and I'm just curious, do you see that across Europe, or are we just the only people having that debate?
I think for now it's a debate that is very much alive in certain capitals. I think definitely in Ireland, Dublin, that's a debate. In Brussels, it's for now less of a debate. I think there is definitely awareness that energy and AI is somewhat at odds with one another, and especially the use of the deployment of AI can impact the bloc's climate targets. That's definitely something that people in Brussels are aware of. But we haven't seen any talk about regulation there, or we haven't seen any plan for that now. I think there is definitely, von der Leyen has said at the start of her second term that she wants to make AI more, that she wants to ensure that AI is applied more across industry. And for that, of course, you need data centers, but you also need skilled people. You need a lot of things for that. So that's what she's definitely focused on. But data centers is a bit of a difficult one, because things like permits and making sure that there is enough energy supply is very much at the national level and less at the EU level. So that's a bit of a, that's always the problem in Brussels, is that sometimes you're confronted with a problem, but you don't have always the competencies to tackle that.
Fascinating perspective on it from you there, Peter. Thank you very much for taking the time to join with us today. We really appreciate it. That was Peter Haig from Political Europe. Thank you. You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. Now, John Grace from The Guardian newspaper will be with us after this short break to discuss Boris Johnson's new book, Unleashed, and he'll be trying to explain exactly what's going on in the leadership race in the Tory party. So stay tuned for that. You're welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, this is our final item today. And between determining who the next party leader might be and delving into the exploits of one of its most recent, and not to mention infamous leaders, it's been all eyes on the Tory party this week in the UK. Who's the front runner in the race? Who's going to take the helm there? And also, did we learn anything really from Boris Johnson's newly published political memoir this week? Well, I'm delighted now to be joined by John Crace, who is the Guardian's parliamentary sketch writer. John, you're welcome back to Taking Stock.
Hi there.
Now, John, before we talk about Boris Johnson or anything to do with the Tory party, we got to start with your own book, which was also released this week. And it's called Taking the Lead, A Dog at Number 10. I've pre-ordered it. And I've got to tell you, as political books go, it has to be the most adorable cover I have ever seen. What's the premise behind this book?
The premise, it started as a sort of satirical idea. I mean, because we often say a dog could have done better than this. And I kind of look back at my dog happens to be a 13 years old and so has known sort of five Tory MP prime ministers who have been of dubious quality, some of them. And I kind of thought, wouldn't it be fun to write a book in which my dog had been part of the political system? So he gets his first job working for Ed Miliband as a political advisor. And then when Ed Miliband loses the election, he loses his job. But then David Cameron appoints him to work on the Vote Remain team. And so it all spirals from there. It's sort of Paddington Bear and
Yes, Prime Minister.
Animal Farm.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, his name is Herbie. He's adorable. He's on the front cover. And I don't know. I don't know if it was aimed at people like me, people who are political anoraks. It was the little extract I did read when you buy the pre-order was really funny. Who are you aiming this at?
I think anyone who with people who are looking to be, you know, politically engaged, but want to be entertained. And, you know, we all get ground down by the news sometimes, and sometimes you just need to laugh at it. And sometimes also humour can expose truths that otherwise go hidden.
Well, look, it's a fascinating perspective and I'm really looking forward to reading it. Good luck with it, John. I'm sure it's going to be a bestseller. But will it sell more than Boris Johnson's book? That's what we maybe look at now. So Boris Johnson had his book out this week. It's called Unleashed. Did you get any side of it? Have you heard anybody who's read it or what are the reviews saying?
I have, for my sins, read every single page of its 730 pages.
Oh, God. And you're okay.
I still carry the scars. I mean, because the main thing that the main surprise for me, not that it was quite self-serving and unreflective, because in a way, that's sort of Boris Johnson's trademark. What I found most unforgivable was that it was actually quite boring because all the stuff was well rehearsed. He doesn't appear to be giving any kind of great detail on, you know, events in Westminster. I mean, one of the key things that political nerds like myself want to know is what was his relationship with Dominic Cummings really like? They worked together on vote leave. Then he brought him back as chief of staff in 2019 when he became prime minister. And, you know, within a year, that relationship had deteriorated really badly. You know, I expected, you know, at least a couple of chapters on that. But Dominic Cummings sort of comes and goes in two or three pages. Mm-hmm. And you're left thinking, what's going on? Especially when there's a sort of 100 pages devoted to how he was the best mayor London had ever had. And I mean, to be fair, he was a better Lord Mayor of London than he was Prime Minister of the UK. But I don't think that's what people will be shelling out the £30 for to discover, you know, what you know, how the the London Olympics went.
There may be a sense that he's dialing it in, but will it sell? You know, do people care? Like, are they that interested in him still, or has his moment passed?
I don't know. That's a really good question. I mean, I kind of feel partly the moment will have passed. I mean, he sold the serialization rights to the Daily Mail in the UK, and you see that the Daily Mail was scrabbling around for sort of news lines to use. And the best they could come up with was that during the COVID pandemic, Boris Johnson had once, as a joke, suggested to the military that they should do a raid on
Norway or something, was it? Yeah.
The Netherlands.
Yeah, Netherlands, yeah, for their vaccines, wasn't it?
Yeah,
maybe
deranged.
But maybe, you know, when we're looking at a political autobiography, we're always looking for something like an expose or an apology, some deep insight into a relationship. Maybe with Boris Johnson, everything about him is already so mad and out there, he actually can't surpass that.
I think that's almost certainly where we're at. And you kind of get the feeling that in the various interviews that Boris Johnson has been doing to sell the book, you know, he's been going sort of out of his way to try and create news lines and to stir up some interest. But you can almost sort of feel that almost everyone who might have been interested in the book will have read and gathered everything they would need to know already.
And do you think that there might be, you know, with Brexit, the whole country went through so much, first of all, in trying to get Brexit done. And on the other side of it, obviously, all of those promises have not been realised, and the carnage and the chaos that has been inherited now by the Labour Party going, do you think maybe people feel a bit resentful towards Boris Johnson and maybe like, you know, I'm just done with that. We've got to get on. We've got to move on.
I do think that. And I also think that anyone who does read the Brexit section in the book will again be kind of disappointed because sort of Boris Johnson's delivers a sort of non-apology. He says that we ought to be pleased with what we've got. And he also said that, you know, if he looked a bit surprised and didn't have much to say on the morning after the referendum, it was because he never expected to have to deliver Brexit. So he was always just an activist. And I think that the very least, those of us who voted Remain hoped that the Brexiteers had a coherent plan for how to deliver Brexit. But it's clear from where we are now, 8 years on, that they haven't. They still haven't. It still isn't done. And it's still costing the UK economy, you know, billions of pounds a year.
Well, look, it's called Unleashed. And it's ironic because now he seems that he was unleashed whilst in office and he's censoring himself when he's out of office. But anyway, we move on to what's happening now in the Tory party, because extraordinary events, John, this week in the race to define who and decide who would be the next leader. Maybe just take us through where you were at the beginning of the week, who the candidates were, because it's not front page news here in Ireland who they are, but it is an important part of British politics. So take us through the three people who were in the running at the beginning of the week.
Well, there were actually four people in the running. There were four leadership contestants left. On the right of the party, there was Robert Jenrick and Kemi Badenoch. And in the centre of the party, there was James Cleverly and Tom Tugendhat. On Monday, the 121, well, it turned out to be 120 because Rishi Sunak didn't vote. The 120 Tory MPs voted to eliminate Tom Tugendhat. He came last by quite a long way. He just picked up just 20 votes. And out in the lead was James Cleverly with 39 votes. And then on the Tuesday, the next day, there was this the fourth round of voting. And all the pundits, myself included, seemed to think that it was inevitable that James Cleverly, I mean, he effectively only needed one more vote to ensure making it into the last two. And it seemed natural that many of Tom Tugendhat's votes would, being a centrist, would go to James Cleverly, another centrist. So we all thought that James Cleverly was a shoo-in to be one of the last two, and that the real contest was between Kemi Badenoch and Robert Jenrick to get on the ballot paper. But to everyone's astonishment, it turned out that sort of Kemi Badenoch and Robert Jenrick got 42 votes and 41 respectively, and that James Cleverly went down a vote to 38.
Oh, it's extraordinary. I mean, I remember when I first started working in politics, somebody said to me, listen, the biggest piece of advice I can give you is in politics, there's only one thing you actually need to be able to do, and it's the ability to count. You've got to be able to count your votes. So what happened here? Do you think that this was an attempt by Cleverly to try and shore up support for the weaker candidates and he accidentally knocked himself out?
Well, that is certainly one of the theories doing the round. And most, and I mean, unfortunately, we will never know.
It's secret, is it?
It's all the ballot is secret, and none of the people, if there was sort of vote rigging of some kind, no Tory MP is going to admit to it. So, I mean, that is a secret that I don't think we will ever discover. I mean, it is either that or the Tory party had a kind of collective brain fade.
Or, if you look at Badenoch and Jenrick, they could be considered a much more extreme side of the Tory party, and Cleverly seeing much more as a centrist, as you said there. Perhaps this is indicative of a Tory party seeing itself going more vehemently towards the right in the coming years. And it wasn't an accident, and it isn't something that happened by default, but by design.
Well, I mean, a lot of the Tory, I mean, I think it's really interesting today that the Tory One Nation group of the centrist Tory MPs are refusing to back either Badenoch or Jenrick. And so there is now a kind of split within the Tory party, because I think most, I mean, the point is that the next electorate for the leadership isn't Tory MPs. They've done their bit. It's the 120,000 or so, we don't know how many there are exactly, Tory members get to have the final say of, you know, which one wins. And traditionally, the Tory part, the Tory membership have been well to the right of Tory, you know, just ordinary Tory voters.
So they chose Liz Truss over Rishi Sunak. Was that a demonstration of that, or am I getting that wrong?
Absolutely. And I mean, that was a disaster for the Tory party. That contributed to their, you know, 2024 election defeat to Keir Starmer. People hadn't forgotten that, you know, their mortgages had gone up substantially amid the chaos of Liz Truss's 49 days.
Now, between Badenoch and Jenrick, like, who do you think is the front runner now, and what might we expect from either of them if they were to become Tory leader?
Well, Jenrick is playing to the reform crowd very much so. He's going on and on about immigration and about the need to leave the European Court of Human Rights. And this is very much Nigel Farage territory. I mean, a lot of Tories would be very, very worried about this kind of move because, you know, the idea that you can tempt reform voters back without losing votes from the centre and the left of the party is, you know, I mean, it's just absurd. So there will be a trade-off. And, you know, I don't think tacking right necessarily gives the Tories more support. Badenoch is much more of the populist Trump card. You know, she plays the culture wars. She picks fights with anyone and anything. I mean, even herself. I mean, and she is much more of a loose cannon. I mean, she was the one, you know, at the Tory party conference who first of all declared that maternity pay wasn't necessarily a good thing, thereby sort of alienating, you know, huge numbers of sort of married couples or people with children.
Mm.
And then she had a go at the civil service saying that 10% of them should be in prison.
Yeah.
I mean, she is a strange woman, and not necessarily one who will endear herself to the country. So, I mean, the feeling very much is without Cleverly in the final mix, the Tories are sort of left themselves, you know, stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Well, it's all good news for Keir Starmer, though. Presumably the Labour Party now have less of a coherent and cogent party to oppose them as they set off on this, what they say themselves is a big journey to try and turn the country around.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Keir Starmer is, and the Labour Party are absolutely delighted. I mean, there were loads of sort of jokes going around on Twitter yesterday, you know, oh, this is the best freebie we've ever had. and I mean, it's also a gift for sketch writers like me, because Kemi Badenoch and Robert Jenrick being sort of more extreme personalities are much more fun to write about.
Well, look, you'd wonder what Herbie the dog would make of all this, and maybe there's a sequel coming on your book, but for now we're going to have to leave it there. That was John Crace, The Guardian parliamentary sketch writer, and his book is out this week. Highly recommendable. It's called Taking the Lead, A Dog at Number 10. John, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app. Thanks as always to all of today's guests for their very valuable time and insights. The producer of Taking Stock was John Fardy, Simon Keane and Stephen Daunter on research, and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Anton Savage is coming up next with all your Sunday newspapers and lots, lots more. But from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thank you for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.